money. And they say, well, might as well get more of them. So the first thing that happens is that the interest rate is constantly rising around the world. It's not going down. It's constantly rising. Why? Because they're creating products, they're making demand, and the people have, you know, the need to buy them, and therefore everything goes higher. Back in the day, people weren't interested in buying houses as much as now, because people weren't brainwashed back in the day to have a house. They were happy, you know, two families living in one house, or a father having all his kids in one house, and so on and so forth. And people were, you know, able to build even their own houses without needing permits and what have you these days. But now they changed that ideology. They made it sound like if you want to live a happy life, you need to have a house. In order to have a house, obviously you need to have a loan. And now everyone is going towards buying houses. And when that happens, there's a demand for housing, then the bank comes to the rescue. They say, okay, we can give you a loan. And slowly, slowly, the rates keep going higher and higher and higher. That's one. Two, the prices of products will also go higher in the market, right? Because there is a lot of people taking loans and people giving loans. Then in some parts, the products will become less, and some parts might become more. So then you'd have the currency limited to certain places. So also that affects people in terms of how they deal, not only with the money that they have to give as interest goes higher, but also even in terms of products that they have to buy and consume. So we don't want that to happen. And when people indulge themselves in these kind of loans that's based on interest, the wealth gets given to a specific group of people. It goes to the bank, for example, or to the government, and no one else gets it. So we all, when we want to buy houses, all of us putting all our savings and giving it all to the bank. Why? Just so I can see a letter or a word that says, this is your house. And well, technically speaking, it's not yours until you pay it off in another 50 years, if you can afford it. That's if you live long enough to enjoy it, to say the least. So this is the problem with us. So the problem is that it makes the cost of living higher. It makes certain people, certain organizations, for example, the banks, richer, and we get poorer and poorer and poorer. So this is one of the side effects and the bad negative effects of interest on people. And that's why Allah says that should not happen. That is completely forbidden. Let us take a short break and then we will come back, inshallah.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program for humanity. Now, when we look at the devastating effects of riba and interest, it obviously it's in level. So it has the economical level in terms of wealth, which we kind of touched upon. And also, it has like a spiritual and on the person himself, it would leave a negative impact. Because interest, it threatens societies and the safety of societies. Because it will form relationships between people based on hate, animosity, jealousy. And these kind of relationships that are based on these, they will obviously break. And they will collapse, and then the whole society collapse with it. Because there are those who are in power, they decide to give loans to people based on interest. And then obviously, the more these people ask of you, you're not going to give them love and affection. You're going to be hating them. And once this hate starts spread around, then we become a very corrupt society. So unless we learn to come to each other's help and aid without having to ask anything in return, then we won't have this problem. So this also happens. And sometimes when it comes to interest, what happens is that the concept of helping one another does not exist. Because if I would want to help you, have mercy on you, be equal to you, be supportive to you, then I shouldn't be asking you for interest, should I? When I ask you for interest, these things don't exist anymore. Like, you know, help, mercy, equalization, support between people, it will fade away. So this is also another problem that happens on the emotional level of people that sometimes we need to pay attention. And sometimes what happens is that those who deal in interest and those who take a loan on interest, they might face a stage where they themselves, they can't pay back that money, which means that it becomes an inheritance to their kids. So if a person dies and he has plenty of interest to pay and he can't, then it goes to the children. The children have to pay for it. So it also affects them on a personal level and on a mental level. So even that is also considered into account when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala made interest forbidden. So whether it is money itself, it's got a problem, or when it has a problem on the mentality and personality of people, that when it comes to riba and interest, it destroys the fabric of society and the fabric of relationships. So inshallah, we will leave it at this point, and we will continue our discussion in the next episodes. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. Eye on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week, we'll look at a trending news story which has a direct relevance to the religion of Islam, and we'll break it down from a Muslim perspective. On today's show, we'll be talking about the hijab and the debate regarding hijab laws in Muslim countries like the Islamic Republic of Iran. So let's kick off this episode with a deep dive into the violent protests which have emerged following the unfortunate death of Iranian woman Mahsa Amini in September of this year. Her death saw a rapid rise in Islamophobic anti-hijab sentiment being expressed by the various radical groups who seem to have hijacked her name as part of a movement campaigning for the destruction of Islam in Iran and elsewhere.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has come under a sustained attack from a persistent, violent protest movement in recent weeks, with anti-Iran demonstrators seemingly obsessed with criticism of Iran's laws on modesty and compulsory hijab. The riots first broke out in Iran in mid-September after the death of Iranian woman Mahsa Amini. The 22-year-old fainted at a police station in Tehran and was pronounced dead 3 days later in hospital. An official report by Iran's legal medicine organization concluded that Amini's death was caused by illness rather than alleged blows to the head or other vital body organs. However, her death was quickly adopted as a means by various groups to attempt to topple the government.
They've got an agenda. I feel like they are well supported by the British, by the West, by the Israelis, and that's why they're here.
Footage has gone viral showing protesters burning hijabs, attacking mosques, and desecrating spiritual artwork. In response to the violence, millions of Iranians have marched across Iran over multiple occasions this year, defending the hijab and condemning attacks against Iranian security forces by demonstrators. The unrest has been used as a precursor to renew Western debate over Iran's mandatory hijab laws and women's rights from a Western perspective.
Well, joining us in the studio today to talk about the importance of the hijab in Islam and the anti-Iran protests, we have Sister Batul Subaiti, a political activist and commentator based here in London. And also joining me is Sheikh Taqi Jafar Razawi. He is a scholar based in London who has been involved in Islamic dissemination amongst the youth for the last three decades and works in community activities, both religious and social. Thank you to both of you for joining me on the show, and salamu alaikum to you both. Perhaps I could come straight to you, Sayyid, and ask you about what does Islam say about the hijab? What's the position of the hijab in Islam?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think what's really important to understand, hijab is not a item of just clothing, but it's a existence of an individual in relation to what they can associate with and cannot associate with. And Quran and various aspects of the Quran and traditions quite clearly talk about association in the sense of mahram and non-mahram, in other words, those who are immediate family and those who are not immediate family. And that's where the hijab comes in, because whilst one associates with immediate family, in other words, the various parts of the ayat of the two ayats mainly in Surah Nur, which is the 24th Surah of the Quran, mm-hmm. which ayat number 30 and 31, in which they quite clearly say, I mean, there's the ayat which says to the men that they should lower their gaze, and there's the ayat number 30 which says to the women that they should lower their gaze. Whilst Islam does say, I mean, the ayat which is number 31, quite clearly says that who one can interact with. It says that you can interact with you can appear without a hijab with your husbands, your husband's father, your husband's sons. All those interactions also have their own categories. You know, like you have a female who can appear in a particular manner in front of her husband, she cannot appear in that particular manner in front of her father. And society would condemn the woman if she tried to appear in the manner that she appears in front of her husband, as she would appear in front of her father. When society has these prerogatives and previously set standards, Islam goes a little bit further and says, look, because women are not just left to be locked up in the home, they will interact with men, they will interact with people who are not their mahram, not their immediate family. Therefore, when that takes place, then Islam says, well, make sure that you then interact with in a such a manner that you will not be infringing the rights of those who are not your mahram to see you, and likewise you will not be found, you will not be doing something which is contradicting your religious responsibilities in relation to interaction. And that ayat which I said, the 30th ayat of Surah Nur, it says to men as well, that if they come across women who are not their immediate families, immediate relatives, then they too must lower their gaze.
So it seems to me like the concept of hijab is quite differently seen. It's a different perspective from the Muslim world. It's about protecting the woman and giving her an opportunity to enter into the public space in a protected manner. I'm going to come to you, Sister Batul, now and ask for your opinion. You're obviously a practicing hijabi. You wear it quite proudly, I see. Could you just tell me, are you oppressed?
That's very funny, actually. The whole crux of the hijab is to free you from everything apart from God and submission to God. So the primary reason for why I wear the hijab is out of sheer and pure obedience to God. So I view it less as a choice of how to dress and more of a choice of whether or not I'm submitting to God the Almighty. From a secondary perspective, also just to echo what the Sayyid was saying, I do believe the hijab is an essential component of a healthy society. For me personally, I believe it has prevented me from being in many otherwise unideal or harmful situations. Of course, being a representative of Islam, it always keeps me in check. I believe it has also protected me from the lustful gaze of men. I also believe it's a protection for men themselves to not fall prey to that due to the way that God has created both males and females. I also believe the essence of the hijab is to restore equality between the males and the females. It's to remove the element of discrimination that relegates a woman's potential and worth to her level of sexual attraction. So essentially, it's there to facilitate the interaction of women and their participation in wider society rather than to limit. And I'll end by saying also that I think the body is a very private entity and reality of a woman. It should be respected. It should be honored. Mm-hmm. And the whole essence of the hijab is to basically ensure that it's safeguarded both the body and the soul from moral corruption.
Because I know that the other side of the argument might suggest, well, actually, it's liberating for a woman to wear less rather than more. What's your response to that?
I mean, that's very funny, I would say, because actually a tool of social control, and the capitalists themselves and those at the top, they actually relish out of creating money from this industry of sexualizing women and actually utilizing women for their own satisfaction. The hijab comes and says, do you know what? We want you to be the most effective when you interact with society. So this is how you should interact to minimize instincts, because you are worthy as an entity and your output for society is what worthy, not the way that you look.
Fantastic. And Sayed, let me come back to you on this. About the hijab again, I wonder about what Islam's position is on the fact that there are laws in Muslim countries, Muslim-majority countries, which are now in place, which basically make women have to wear it in the public space, even women who potentially don't want to wear it if given the choice. What's the Islamic view on that? Should that be the case in Muslim-majority countries?
I mean, look at a tradition from Hazrat Fatima Zahra, salamu alayha. When she was passing away, she writes a will to Mawla Ali, Amir al-Mumineen Ali ibn Abi Talib, and she says that when my body is being carried, I don't want to be carried with just a sheet on my body, for I will be visualized by people who will see my body being carried to the grave. I want to be put in a tabut. I want to be put in a coffin, such that my respectability, even to my death, is kept to me, not enabled others who want to abuse that respectability that the Holy Prophet had granted me be seen and visualized. And what the sister says is quite interesting, that, and it's important, there's a tradition from Mawla Ali. He says a female should keep herself busy in demonstrating obedience to the Creator rather than be busy in how she impresses her appearance to others. And that's a very important tradition, because in obedience to the Creator, every aspect of one's behavioral life then is generated around that of protecting oneself to be close to the Creator rather than close to the eyes of those who want to abuse the appearance of the individual. So these traditions are quite strong. I mean, and then, of course, we have the issues regarding Karbala, where Imam Hussein's family was taken as asir, as prisoners, to Yazid's audience. And there, even the ladies were trying to hide behind each other to prevent themselves from being seen by those present in Yazid's domain. So, you know, that aspect of self-protection is more in the definition rather than be defined as mandatory imposing of something.
And I just want to make this point very clear as well. How important is the hijab in Islam? Because I know that there might be kind of like a reformist mentality coming out of the West now, where even among Muslims they're arguing, well, how important is the hijab? Do I really have to wear it?
You see, hijab, or a clothing of modesty, was something which even in the West was well respected. Even in the Victorian, they would say, oh, that's Victorian and now we're progressing. But the point is, it's not the issue of the item, it's the changing of its use, where the liberation is being given to take the woman out of dressing. But it's really interesting. One of these Somalian ladies was being given a award in the United Nations, and she went in her full hijab. So somebody asked her, why are you in hijab? So she says, you know, in the times when people were walking around without clothes, we called them barbaric. Mm. And now you want me to return to the environment of the barbaric lives where I'm without clothes?
That is
the reality.
That's an interesting point, yes. Yeah, it's a double standard.
It's a double standard
there.
Because whilst you are promoting the removal of barbaric appearance, you're telling people who are in decent appearance to become barbaric.
Yes, it's double standards there. We're going to continue this discussion. Okay, before we continue our discussion on the hijab and Islam, let's have a look at some other Islamic stories that have been trending lately. The US men's football team have caused outrage by displaying Iran's national flag on social media without the Allah emblem of the Islamic Republic. Ahead of the two nations' recent World Cup match, the US team also said they support so-called protesters in Iran. According to FIFA regulations, the US soccer team should have been punished with a 10-match suspension for violating Iran's religious identity, but this didn't happen. Newly released census data shows that there are now 3.9 million Muslims in England and Wales, an increase of 1.2 million people over the last decade. This means there are now around 4 million Muslims living in the UK if the Muslim populations of Scotland and Northern Ireland are taken into account. London is the place with the highest concentration of Muslims. There are now over 1.3 million Muslims living in the British capital. And Islamic Party PAS has emerged as one of the biggest winners in Malaysia's general election, which was won by the reformist candidate Anwar Ibrahim. PAS, which has long been a powerhouse in northeast Malaysia, is now a national force by winning the most seats of any party. It espouses Islamic law for Malaysia, which runs contrary to Anwar's vision of a multicultural society. Protests against Islam and Iran have remained ongoing for a number of weeks, and not that long ago, I decided to attend one of these rallies in London, which luckily didn't turn violent, but gave me a chance to find out who are the protesters and what are the ideologies we're dealing with as part of this movement.
Few could be surprised about the regime change mission of the anti-Iran protesters. But what may be lesser known is the militant Islamophobic Western ideologies, which have essentially hijacked Mahsa Amini's name to further their own personal agendas. At one of the London rallies, it was clear that each protester had their own views on what they ultimately wanted to force onto Iranians. Militant Western feminism, LGBT activists, and Kurdish nationalism, just a few of the ideologies which had clearly linked up to push their own self-centered worldviews onto Mahsa Amini and the anti-Iran movement as a whole, with the ambition to ultimately destroy one of the Middle East's Islamic republics.
Welcome back to the discussion now, where I've been discussing the hijab and Islam with my two expert guests. Now, I'm going to come straight back to you, Sister Batul, about what's happening here. So I spoke to some of these activists. It's quite clear that they want much more for Iran than just freedom and human rights and so on and so forth. They want things like regime change. They want the rainbow propaganda machine to be flying the flag in Tehran, that type of thing. A lot of militant feminists want to completely remove clothes entirely, which I think is a bit too far even for some liberal standards. Just tell me, why is the hijab specifically the kind of target for these type of radical Western groups? Why are they burning it?
Right, because it's ultimately the symbolism of the hijab in terms of what it is representing. Now, I don't think they have a problem in and of itself with the practice of the hijab per se as a practice. Rather, it is the spirit of Islam. It is the spirit of Islam that says no to any form of cultural hegemony or submission to the dictates of any oppressive law or man-made law that is outside of the trajectory of God's law. So essentially, that is the crux of the issue that they have. So the way that I look at them is that these individuals are brainwashed, and these individuals have fell into the trap of the soft war campaign of the West, that inherently the reason that it attacks Iran is because Iran has this strong independent line, and ultimately the West wants the whole trajectory of the world to submit to their cultural hegemony and to their dictates and to their rules. So I think naturally in that circumstance, it would view the hijab as a threat in terms of being the symbol for a true free Islam. So for example, you won't see them complain about the hijab in Saudi Arabia, for example, because Saudi Arabia essentially is acting as a client state for the US. So they don't have a problem with that kind of hijab. They have a problem with the spirit that accompanies the true philosophy and embodiment and practice of the hijab, that is submission to none other than God. And they are the hegemons of the world, and they want to maintain that unjust status quo. So naturally, the real philosophy of the hijab will be a threat to them.
And how important do you think the hijab has been with with Islam in general in countries like Iran? How important is it for the national identity there?
Absolutely. As I have just mentioned, you know, the true embodiment of the hijab is one of freeing the individual from all that restricts them and ultimate submission to God. And that is the trajectory that Iran has taken in 1979. So I would argue that Iran, the Islamic Republic, is a true Islamic Republic in the real sense of the world, because this was the will of the people. The strength of the system in Iran ultimately rests on the people. You know, it was the people that came out on the streets and said, no East, no West, Islamic Republic. And you had a 98% votes for this, with a 90% voter turnout. And ultimately, the only reason that Iran is standing today is because of the people. Because if we look at 40 years of embargoes, sieges and sanctions and conspiracies of the worst kinds, from assassinations to defamation campaigns to a literal military campaign for 8 years in the Iran-Iraq war, all of that is designed to do what? It's designed to crush the spirit of the Iranian people. But ultimately, not only has that not succeeded, it has backfired. Today, Iran has the strongest, I would argue, economy in the world, because it's self-sufficient, because it's reliant upon itself. Now, what does it mean to be reliant upon itself? It means it's reliant on its domestic capabilities. So no matter how many times we see these protesters coming out, another great evidence is that you will see 10 times the amount of these protesters coming in Iran to defend the ideals of the revolution. We see this on the anniversary of the revolution in Bahman. We see this during Al-Quds Day, which is reaffirming the values of the revolution. We see this when individuals are assassinated, you know, whether it's Haj Qasem Soleimani, who's considered a national hero, or Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who was a nuclear scientist, for example. These are all evidence and indicators that truly the system rests on the people, and they are a minority who are protesting.
I think it's also really interesting that there's clearly double standards at play here, because a lot of these movements are condemning Muslim countries for basically being Muslim, but then they're not speaking up for women who, Muslim women living in Europe, for example, right, who are being told, no, you can't wear the burqa, you can't wear the hijab in some circumstances, and basically oppressing their rights to choose what they want to wear. So blatant hypocrisy in that standard as well. Sayed, I'm going to come back to you on this. There are clearly debates going on, even among Muslims, regarding the hijab and so on and so forth. It's a challenge, I think, for Muslims in the West specifically, to have to wear it, to have to live an Islamic lifestyle among non-Muslims amid the Islamophobic atmosphere that we live in as well. What's your advice to women who are perhaps struggling with this issue of the hijab?
I think main important thing is that one establishes one's own religiosity about what this is all about, you know, because as there was just a report recently which said that, you know, now the level of Christianity is also dropped below 50% in the community. That's because they're identifying themselves more with atheism and consequently the disobedience to the Creator. And hijab and all these other aspects of self-protection is something which is a universal thing. You know, in Surah Shams, Quran says, فَأَلْهَمَهَا فُجُورَهَا وَتَقْوَاهَا, that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has inspired the soul to understand good and bad. And understanding good and bad is within the domains of the environment that one is living in. That when one sees suppression of women's rights, in the sense of Islam doesn't say, it doesn't talk about equality, Islam talks about equity, in the sense of that which is the rightful, that which is a right of the individual to have, not that which is just given to the person because somebody else feels that is somebody's right to have. And that's why it's so important that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's understanding of human needs are quite clearly nurtured in the behavior of the human being and how they behave with people around them. Obviously, as not only just in Britain and how, or in Western countries where Muslim women are stressed in trying to identify themselves as an identity of what form they should take, it's something which has been imposed in Muslim countries during the time of the colonial powers and how they made people unhijabbed in the sense how they promoted women who were more freer to hang around with colonial powers. Then they gave them more powers and more positions. And they used women as tools of espionage in Muslim countries to get, I mean, one of those individuals who was well known for her espionage and behavior was Gertrude Bell. and how she interacted without hijab, so as to say, within the Muslim elite, pulling the elite towards the desire to have worse social behaviors than to promote good social behaviors. And of course, the strength of the Islamic leadership in the form of the Maraji, who gave the rulings of how important the hijab is for sisters to possess for themselves, that played a major part in making sure that we understood how we should interact with the item of protection.
For sure. Now, we haven't got very long left of the show, so I'm going to come back to you, sister, for a final take. Could you just tell me about how is it that Mahsa Amini, I've never met Mahsa, but she doesn't seem like, you know, a militant Western feminist advocate to me. How is it that her name, her brand, became hijacked essentially by these Western groups?
Right. I think by now people probably know that there were 275 million tweets in the name of Mahsa Amini. That is not normal. That magnitude of systemic campaign and aggression against the Islamic Republic on Iran on something that was supposedly alleged tells you that surely there's a greater game at play here. Ultimately, I don't believe that the West is hellbent, quote unquote, on regime change in Iran. And the reason I will say this is because they're not naive. They know Iran has reached a position of strength where there is no going back, essentially. They've tried every single means and tactics that exists for them to fragment the nation. I mean, we saw this with the 2009 quote-unquote Green Revolution, right? We saw that when tens of Iranians came out on the streets when they felt like there might be a threat on the government, that they ultimately drowned those protesters. We saw that. So ultimately, what the West is seeking to do right now is to apply internal pressure through unleashing its underground collaborator networks and their underground hidden cells in order to wreak havoc, to pressurize Iran, so perhaps it might be able to get some concessions on an international scene. It was a pretext to also put sanctions, for example, on Iran to weaken it. But it's not quote-unquote regime change.
Using day tactics to try and get what they want out of Iran. And I think it's worth mentioning that there were huge protests in support of the Islamic Republic during this whole affair. That's something worth mentioning as well. But thank you very much to both of my guests today. It's been a very enlightening discussion, to say the least. But that's all the time we have for this edition of Eye on Islam. But join us next week for another edition. And for now, Salaamu Alaikum.
In the limelight.
After two decades that have passed since the beginning of the illegal occupation of Afghanistan by American, British, and NATO forces, new dimensions of the crimes of the invaders are publishing every day. In one of them, the British ministers recently have announced an inquiry into charges of more than 50 summary killings by Special Air Service soldiers in Afghanistan, a decision made after years of reports that British occupying troops killed civilians in cold blood. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world press and news agencies to shed more light on the issue. Please stay tuned. The website of Euronews writes, Britain's military has announced it will launch an inquiry into reports that its special forces carried out dozens of extrajudicial killings in Afghanistan. Junior Defense Minister Andrew Morrison said in the House of Commons on Thursday, December 15th, that the UK Ministry of Defense, MOD, would concede to long-standing demands for an independent statutory inquiry. BBC reported earlier this year that British Elite Special Air Service, SAS, killed Afghan civilians in cold blood. Morrison admitted the Afghanistan inquiry, which is to start in early 2023, will focus on unlawful killings by the British Special Forces during deliberate detention operations in Afghanistan from mid-2010 to mid-2013. It will also examine the adequacy of subsequent investigations by the Ministry of Defense into charges of wrongdoing, including murder. However, Morrison noted the inquiry will ensure that all service personnel, veterans and current and former civil servants who are asked to engage with the inquiry will be given full legal and pastoral support. The announcement follows reports that 54 Afghans were killed in suspicious circumstances by one SAS unit in Helmand province between 2010 and 2011 and charges that this amounted to war crimes. Tessa Gregory from the UK law firm, which is representing the families of the deceased, said an inquiry should have been launched years ago. She said the charges of extrajudicial killings and cover-up are of such gravity and the concerns expressed contemporaneously within the British and Afghan army and by a reputable international organization working on the ground in Afghanistan were so serious and so widespread that an inquiry should have been instituted by the government years ago. The families of eight people, including three young boys reportedly murdered by British Special Forces in two separate operations during night raids in Afghanistan in 2011 and 2012, welcomed the inquiry, saying they waited 10 years for justice. One of the family members said, "Over 10 years ago, I lost two of my brothers, my young brother-in-law, and a childhood friend, all boys with a life ahead of them," adding, "I was handcuffed, beaten, and interrogated outside our family home by British troops. My relatives and friends were each shot in the head as they sat drinking tea." The family member said, "My family had waited 10 years to find out why this happened." Meanwhile, The Guardian Daily reports ministers have announced a statutory judge-led inquiry into allegations of more than 50 summary killings by SAS soldiers in Afghanistan, a decision made after years of reports that elite British troops killed civilians in cold blood. In a statement to the House of Commons, Andrew Morrison, the Minister for Defence, said Lord Justice Haddon Cave would take on the job and work would start in earnest in 2023. Haddon Cave will stand down for his job as a senior presiding judge for England and Wales to focus on the task. John Healy, the Shadow Defence Secretary, said this special inquiry is welcome and must succeed. "It is essential to protect the reputation of our British Special Forces, guarantee the integrity of military investigations, and secure justice for any of those affected." A High Court case brought by the law firm Lay Day on behalf of one man, Saifullah, charged that his father, two brothers and a cousin were killed during an SAS raid on a compound in southern Afghanistan in February 2011. It was called Objective Tyburn by the SAS, referring to a historic place of execution in London. Evidence from disclosures required by the courts indicated that Afghan men detained on SAS night raids were often separated from their families and shot dead after they were claimed to have unexpectedly produced a hand grenade or an AK-47 rifle. Saifullah legal team sought a judicial review, arguing that the MOD did not properly investigate charges of unlawful activity and that Britain had breached its human rights obligations by not properly examining them. Internal correspondence revealed that And a Special Air Services Sergeant Major described the episode as the latest massacre. In an email sent the following morning after the report on a mission that led to the deaths of Saifullah family members was filed. Concerns about SAS activity in Afghanistan have been circling around the MOD for years, but criminal investigations were closed 3 years ago without any prosecutions being brought. In 2014, military police launched Operation Northmoor, an investigation into charges of more than 600 offences by British occupation forces in Afghanistan, including the killing of innocent civilians by the SAS. It was wound down in 2017 and closed in 2019, and the MOD said no evidence of criminality was found. The website of Al Jazeera writes the BBC reported following its own four-day probe, unarmed Afghan men were routinely shot dead in cold blood by SAS troops during nighttime raids. The weapons were planted on them to justify the crimes. The Ministry of Defense said in a statement it will also scrutinize the adequacy of the response by the Ministry of Defense, MOD, to the concerns raised about the troops' conduct and assess what lessons can be learned. Defense Secretary Ben Wallace said in a statement, if there are fair lessons to learn, it is right that we consider those fully to ensure all charges are handled appropriately and in equal measure. Wallace said the MOD had made a number of changes in recent years to deal with serious allegations of wrongdoing, including the creation of a Defense Serious Crime Unit. The BBC's Panorama program investigation said senior officers, including General Mark Carlton Smith, who headed UK Special Forces at the time, were aware of concerns within the SAS about the operations, but failed to report them to military police. Under UK law governing the armed forces, it is a criminal offence for commanding officers to fail to inform the military police if they become aware of potential war crimes. In July, before the broadcast of one such program, the MOD accused the broadcaster of engaging in irresponsible, incorrect journalism by being prepared to air the charges in the first place. However, within 24 hours of that statement, there were signs of a change of heart. Military police began a fresh investigation into the charges, in which the BBC and other organizations were asked to share information, and which led to the recent statement.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Utilsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, Hadith of the Day, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we are going to be looking at a very important topic, and that is the topic of extremism or ghuluv. Extremism manifests itself in various forms, we mean by extremism going to an extreme regarding the virtues of the Imams alayhi salam and ascribing to them traits and attributes which they do not really have and which they have not said they have. This is a topic that is very important. This ghuluv or this extremism has been prohibited in the hadith. The Imams themselves were very keen about this topic. They were very concerned that their followers didn't fall into this trap and didn't go to extremes regarding them, as can be seen in this hadith from Imam Baqir alayhi salam. Imam Baqir alayhi salam said, "O community of the Shia," meaning the Shia of the household of Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, "be like the middle saddle cushion on which the extremist who has slid forward falls back, and with which the follower who is yet to come catches up." Upon hearing this, a man called Sa'd from amongst the Ansar asked him, "May I be your ransom? Who is an extremist?" He replied, "They are a group of people who say such things about us that we do not say about ourselves." You know, they ascribe virtues to the A'imma alayhi salam that the Imams themselves never claimed they had. You know, this is clear that there was a group of people, even in the time of the Imams alayhi salam, who used to do this, and the Imams didn't like this. They prohibited them from doing this. The Imam then says, "Neither are these people from us. We don't consider these people our followers, nor do we associate ourselves with them. We don't have any business with them. We don't want to associate with them or meet with them. We don't like them." Then the man asked, the person named Sa'd, he asked, "Who is the follower that is yet to come?" The Imam had said, "And with which the follower who is yet to come catches up." "What does this refer to?" the person asks. The Imam replies, "The one who is searching for good and wants it, and who will eventually attain it and be rewarded for it." Right? This is what this refers to. You know, this is very important, especially a lot of times, especially these days, we consider this era to be an era of science and progress and reason, right? But still we see a lot of people from amongst the followers of the Ahlul Bayt, right? They ascribe certain things in their words or in their deeds. Their deeds might reflect this. They ascribe things to the Imams which are, you know, the certain properties of God. And a lot of times this serves as fodder for the enemies of the Ahlul Bayt and the enemies of Tashayyu. And they use it against them, against us, and to show, and they try to show that, you know, these Shias, they are heretics, and they don't believe in Tawheed and monotheism because of these actions of these Shias. And it's so best to avoid this. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. we're looking at the prohibition of extremism for the Shia in the words of Imam Baqir alayhi salam. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to Peru, the country is unraveling at warp speed. Just last week, Peru's President Pedro Castillo was removed from office. His charge, quote, rebellion, which came after he announced that he would shut down Congress. Enter Castillo's Vice President Dina Boluarte, who was sworn in as the new president, becoming the first female head of state in Peru's history. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at what has happened in Peru and whether the U.S., who has shown support for the coup and the new president, had any role in it. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Arnold August joins us. He's an author and journalist from Montreal. Also joining us is Libra Sankar, who's a contributor at the Troika Collective, joining us from Miami.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Libra Sankara, I'll start with you. If you can please tell us, in so many words, what has happened in Peru? What did Pedro Castillo do to be dealt the harsh hand that he has been dealt with at this point?
So what we have happening in Peru is not anything new to the history. Peruvian politics have unfortunately developed into what is happening today. So what happens? Pedro Castillo represents the indigenous community. He comes from a working class background. And he represents a move towards a Peru that acknowledges the role of working class people, of indigenous people. And so he poses a threat to the working class, or he poses a threat to the far right, people that come from like Fujimori and the Fujimoristas. He also was pushing for a new constitution, which is one of the platforms that he ran on and got high approval for. And so Pedro Castillo represents what the far right fears, which is Peru moving towards a working class politic that benefits the working class people of Peru and the indigenous people of Peru. And this is a very scary thing, which is why a coup has been orchestrated. what Pedro Castillo was pushing for in dissolving Congress is nothing new. In fact, the president prior to him did it, and many other presidents have done it. It's part of their constitution that a president can dissolve Congress if they feel they're not able to move forward. And so Pedro Castillo, unfortunately, is part of a larger plan to continue destabilizing Peru so that U.S. corporations and people like the U.S. ambassador can continue to take advantage of the of Peru as a mineral-rich country and a country that is full of working-class people.
Okay, very good. We're going to get to some of those points a little later, but first, trying to understand how Peru has unraveled at the speed that it has, Arnold August, and our guests there mentioned something that is very key in this, and that is the fact that, you know, this is not anything new, what Pedro Castillo did, which was, in essence, to be more concrete here, it was Article 134 that is something that he enacted, which was only going to be a temporary closure from what we understand, in which the president said new congressional elections would then be held as soon as possible. So are we to take the fact that what was then done to him was part of, as our guests are mentioned, of a bigger plan to oust him?
Yes, of course. I'm quite sure right after he got elected, I'm sure that the United States and their allies in Europe and Canada started to go into action in order to plan what we call lawfare, that is using juridical or so-called legal means to overthrow the elected president. And, you know, we just discussed, you know, the question of the United States' role. I mean, the day before his arrest and the coup took place, the day before, the American embassy in Peru actually met with the opposition. So they are directly involved in that. And I think that the fact that he dissolved the Congress, I perfectly believe, it is a correct decision, while some, you know, middle of the roaders are saying, well, we oppose what happened to him, but the fact that he dissolved the Congress was not right. It was right, because right now, who has the last word on this? It should be the people in the streets. And the people in the streets in Peru right now are calling for a constituent assembly. That is to replace that Congress. So that decision was right, I think, legally, morally, and also historically, because it opens up a new path for the people in the street. And we saw, when we discussed these type of governments before at Press TV, I always presented the position that we cannot, you know, whether it's the left, part of the left tide or not, I always was always of the opinion we cannot concentrate on the personalities who won elections, for example, Boric in Chile, and now Castillo in Peru. What we have to look at is the larger picture. Where did Castillo come from? He came from a mass movement of indigenous workers. He himself is a teacher. And that what brought him into power. And that is why on the ground now, that you were talking about the left, the pink tide. The pink tide in Peru is happening right now.
Indeed. Well, tell us your reaction, if you can, Libra Sankara, to the a move that the VP, Dina Boluarte, made and then became the president, where she accused the president of, the former, I don't want to call him the former president, but it appears that way for now, Castillo, of a coup attempt. And then basically it just happened a few hours later from what we understand, where she became the president. She was sworn in. I mean, why would she be the one chosen for this, do you think? And at this point, obviously, we're seeing the backlash on the streets. So is that a miscalculation on the part of the grand scheme of things?
I think what we have is betrayal. The ambassador of the U.S. met with Dina Boluarte, the so-called president of Peru. And given the trajectory of Peruvian politics, it's also highly unlikely that she herself is going to last until the 2026 elections. And again, Pedro Castillo is the only democratically elected president. The people did not elect Dina Boluarte to lead them. And I think this speaks to the move and the direction that Peru was trying to go into. The comrade just spoke about pink tide. And I think what we see happening in Latin America right now is the U.S. trying to impose unipolarity, and we see pink tide 2.0 coup and coup attempts. This is happening in Peru. They're using lawfare in Argentina, and they're trying to do another coup in Bolivia. And all these happen to be countries that are moving further to the left. So Dina Boluarte is just a pawn in the larger grand scheme of the U.S. trying to maintain its exploitative relationship to countries like Peru, that if